I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. There is probably no tougher issue for urban leaders than education. Fads come, they go, but test scores never quite live up to the promises. Dr. Ken Wong is a national expert on education accountability, and he's found a surprisingly positive correlation between the school systems controlled by mayors and improved education achievement, particularly in the elementary grades. His latest book is The Education Mayor: Improving America's Schools. Ellen Winner and Lois Hetland are also education researchers. In their work for Project Zero at Harvard, they've been uncovering the effect visual arts education has on student achievement, and the result has been to question the very meaning of achievement. Education is our topic today on Smart City, and we'll get started with our conversation right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. Kenneth Wong chairs the Education Department at Brown University. His recent books include The Education Mayor, Improving America's Schools, and Successful School and Educational Accountability. He previously taught at the University of Chicago and at Vanderbilt University, where he was awarded a $10 million grant by the Institute of Education Sciences to establish a new national research center on school choice, competition, and student achievement. Ken served as the center's founding director until his departure to Brown University. Ken, in which cities are mayors now in control of their schools?
There are about 12 cities right now, and that all started in Boston in 1992, and then Chicago in 1995, and all the way to New York City in 2002. And so, in addition, you've got Cleveland, Harrisburg, which is a very small district, about 8,000 students in Pennsylvania. And most recently, you also have Mayor Adrian Fenty in Washington, D.C. And so he's now in charge of the Washington, D.C. school district, which is about 67 to 70,000 students. Now, Philadelphia is a mixed system because both the mayor and the governor jointly appointed the school board. And Philadelphia has been doing that for the last 5 years now. And you also have New Haven, Providence, where I am right now, and Trenton, New Jersey. So those are mid-sized districts that have been under mayoral control. So altogether, we have about a dozen or so urban school systems. And it ranges from, like I said, Harrisburg, from about 7,000 students, to New York City, which is over 1 million students.
Mm. What does mayoral control of schools really mean?
It has several institutional dimensions. The first one is the extent to which mayors appoint members of the school board. Now, this is historically very significant. For about 100 years now, public school systems have been insulated from the municipal governing system. So they run their own election, and then the members of the school board are usually on nonpartisan electoral process, and they have their own budget, and they are not accountable to the mayor or the governor. But now, because of mayoral control, you join the two systems for the first time in 100 years. So what we have here is to have an integration of electoral accountability for the city as a whole, as well as educational performance accountability. And it seems that here is a system where education will now become part of the municipal governing arrangement, because that's exactly what we've been doing with other services. So when we have police and fire and street and sanitation, library system and so on, oftentimes the mayor would be in charge. And the taxpayers would assess the performance of the mayor so that they can come out every 4 years to assess the progress and then see if they want to continue on with the incumbent or not. But education has always been separate from that process. So the way that I look at mayoral control is not only mayoral appointment of school board members, but also an integration of the electoral process for the municipal government as a whole and educational performance. So after mayoral control in these systems, what I see is very interesting is that you will have a lot more headlines on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Chicago Tribune or the Sun Times than before, because now the mayors are in charge in those cities, and it raises the stakes of public education. It raises the visibility of public education in the eyes of the general public, so that you will have a system that becomes more transparent, attract more attention from the media, and you also see a lot more editorial boards discussing, you know, what's going on in public school, and you see editorials all the time and op-ed pieces all the time. So in a way, the mayoral control actually create and broaden the way we discuss and engage in public education.
Besides more headlines, more press attention, perhaps more even public attention, what else do we know for certain about the difference mayoral control has on schools?
There are several differences. The first one is that the mayors are moving more resources into public education, and they are trying to create a stronger enabling set of conditions to support schools and teaching and learning. So, for example, mayors are more engaging in those cities where I call the education mayors. The education mayors are more engaging in management union contract negotiation. And we know that the mayor's office has a lot more of these skill sets to deal with union issues than the school board by themselves. So as a result of mayoral involvement and control, the mayors are moving some of these resources to help negotiate union contracts. So in all these cities now, we see labor peace, we see multi-year union contract, so that the schools would be opening on time. I remember in Chicago when I first studied the Chicago school reform and when Mayor Daley took over in 1995, prior to that, 10 years prior to mayoral control in Chicago, you've got about 9 or 10 teacher strike, and every year the judge would have to step in and have to negotiate and have to make sure the schools are opening on time. And so with mayoral control now in his, 12, 13 years now, and you don't have any, we have not seen any labor strike in Chicago in all these years. So that's one. The second important consequences is clarity of accountability. And that is who exactly is in charge in education, particularly in urban education. Prior to mayoral control, everybody just point fingers at one another and say that, well, I'm only in charge of one piece of the puzzle. So the union would say that, well, I'm only, you know, providing instructional services. But then, but it is the superintendent. The superintendent would say that, well, the school board micromanaging, you know, a lot of activities. The school board would say that, well, the legislature doesn't come in and provide enough resources. So you have a kind of a circular blame game going on, you know, prior to mayoral control. With mayoral control, you clarify accountability. Everybody knows that ultimately the mayor is in charge. And so that creates a set of incentives for the mayor to actually think ahead and streamline and think about exactly how to allocate resources to make a difference, how to target on low-performing schools so that they can perform better, how to build partnership with organizations such as Teach for America, build partnership with university so that they can be a part of the evaluation support system, and on and on. So what I'm seeing, so the second kind of set of consequences is that because of mayoral control, you see a lot more partnership and engagement on the part of civic and community and university institutions. And the third is, of course, student achievement. And what we have done in the last few years, we look at all the systems that I just described, plus compare these systems with comparable urban districts, similar in size and poverty and school density, and followed them for 5 years. So we analyzed 5 years of student achievement data and found that mayoral control system have performed at a faster pace than these other systems. So in other words, they are mayoral control as a factor has contributed significantly, statistically significantly, to the improvement in student achievement, particularly at the elementary level. So when we look at all the grades, third grade, sixth grade, eighth grade reading, and so on and so forth, we found that in both math and reading, actually, mayoral control has contributed in a positive and significant way to student learning. Now, in high school as well, actually, because we know that high school is tougher, across the country, we see crisis at the high school level. And so when we analyze the data, we also see a statistically significant and positive contribution on the part of mayoral control, except that we don't have enough data to draw as strong a conclusion. So, but the direction of that effect is in the right direction.
It's really fascinating that you can draw conclusions about mayoral control and student achievement. That's very good news. So why aren't all cities moving to mayoral control?
Well, some mayors, first of all, are not ready to do it. And even though when we analyze the state of the city addresses, we look at 40, you know, different cities and analyze the state of the city addresses, and we found that a lot of mayors actually talk about education in their state of the city addresses, but they continue to respect this boundary between an independent school system separate from the municipal governance. So the first factor here is the extent to which the mayor themselves feel that they are ready and are willing to take on this challenge. After all, it is a challenge because there are a lot of uncertainty and there are a lot of risk. The risk factor being that what if the mayors cannot turn around the school system? So what we are studying, the 12 cities that I mentioned, these are motivated mayors who are willing to take the risk, who have the political will to make it work, and they show that they are willing to move resources in the low-performing schools and hold people accountable and also, in turn, be held accountable for their own performance. So that's one. The second is there are still a lot of legislative and policy barriers for mayoral control. So in order for mayors to gain control over the school system, the state legislature would have to enable the mayors to do so. So right now, there are about 29 state that have state laws that enable the state to take certain actions when school districts are failing the grade. So which means that there are still 21 states that do not have any law that enable the state to take some kind of action to deal with failing districts. Of the 29 states that have the legislation, not all of them would like them to give the power to the mayor, because as you know, sometimes the mayor and the governor and the legislative majority, they are in the kind of the opposite aisles. They are from different parties. So the question is the extent to which they are able to build the broad legislative coalition in the legislature to pass the enabling legislation so that the mayor can have the opportunity to take over the schools. Now, in the case of Illinois, and also New York City, those are very interesting situations where there were strong legislative coalition at the state level to enable the mayors to take over to those large urban school districts. So the enabling legislative conditions have to be there in order for the mayor to take over. And then the third is that over the years, as you know, public education is an arena that is not short of ideas, particularly reform ideas. And there must be hundreds and hundreds of reform ideas going on. And For example, prior to mayoral control as a reform strategy, a lot of the urban school systems tried to decentralize. For example, in Chicago, from 1988 to 1995, in that 7-year period, they tried the local school council arrangement. So every school would have an elected local school council, and the local school council had the authority to hire and fire the principal and set their school priority. To the extent that at one time they were talking about completely dismantling the district authority. So now mayoral control is kind of the set of reform that come in to complement what was going on in Chicago. So in other words, there were a lot of reform ideas, and if the community were thinking about doing something about public education, there are a lot of stakeholders around the table. So the extent to which there can be a coalition internal to the community, internal to the system, that is another necessary condition. So in other words, a lot of the systems that I talk about prior to mayoral control, there were a sufficient amount of evidence that the system was really failing to the extent that it was in crisis proportion. And they have tried other means to deal with it, and they have not been able to accomplish much through these other venues, be it decentralization, site-based management, or other forms of strategies. And so the mayor was called upon to actually to come in and then try to help to deal with the school reform issue. So in a way, it has to be a localized set of conditions that also that is also very, very important to deal with to develop this kind of mayoral control system.
Rudy Giuliani, when he was mayor of New York City, did not have control of his schools, but seemed to want it. His successor, Michael Bloomberg, indeed does control the city schools. How did that switch happen?
Yeah, I think that is the legislative enabling condition that I just mentioned. That is, it's in order for the mayor in New York City to take over the school system, the mayor cannot just do it single-handedly. It has to have state legislation to enable the mayor, to allow the mayor to do so. And my recollection was that he was not able to form this legislative coalition in the state legislature to do it. Plus, the governor would have to stand behind this initiative. So you've got a lot of these lobbying going on. It is a political process. But once you have the political coalition aligned in one place, like Bloomberg was good at that, so he was able to work with the legislature and the governor to gain this legislative passage. And once you have that done, then it's really hard work. So the enabling process is just a prerequisite. It's a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient. So once you have the legislation, then it is really up to the mayor to put together the organizational and the governing structure. And the question always is, will the mayor sustain his or her attention? Because a lot of folks are still skeptical about mayoral control. They will say that, well, mayors are politicians and they only deal with the political benefits. And when they see that it's a big challenge, when they see how hard it is to teach reading, they will back off and will lose their attention. But interestingly enough, what I'm seeing in these mayoral control cities is that the mayors, all these mayors are willing to stay on focus.
In your research on education mayors, what did you find that you didn't expect to find?
One of the surprises is the importance of some checks and balances to make this mayoral control system work better. But what I found in the research is that if you take into consideration the checks and balances that built into these systems, it will make that system stronger. That is, the mayors who appoint the members of the school board from a nominating process, for example, those are the systems that seem to have even stronger achievement gain. Those are the systems that seem to suggest that they are paying more attention to management accountability. They are more willing to share the data to make the system more transparent and more willing to engage the community. So in some of these systems, I mean, the mayors do not have complete authority to appoint members of the school board. They are actually given a list or a slate from a nominating commission. And the nominating commission comes from community-based organizations and universities and other civic organizations. So in a way, those checks and balances are good for the system to function better.
While I have you, let me ask you this. Do you believe, Ken, that superintendents today need an education background?
So this is an interesting question because I think it's an institutional design question. In the old days, we expect the superintendent to be in charge of everything, you know, to be a good educator, but at the same time also run the business side and managerial side of the school district. But now I think we are getting a little bit more realistic. So you can have a CEO, but then under the CEO, you can have chief academic officer, you can have chief operations and chief accountability and so on. So you can actually have a team-based approach, but have a team accountable to a CEO who would have enough sophisticated managerial organizational experience in running a large, complex organization.
Dr. Kenneth Wong chairs the Education Department at Brown University and is co-author of the book, The Education Mayor, Improving America's Schools. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planet as an assistant editor, Nate Berg.
The subprime mortgage loan meltdown has led many to refer to some of the nation's biggest banks as, quote, predatory lenders. But now the predators are becoming prey as two major cities have filed lawsuits against these prominent lenders. The New York Times reports that the city of Cleveland, Ohio has filed suit against 21 of the country's largest lending institutions, arguing that they knowingly inundated the local market with high-priced loans the borrowers were unlikely to be able to pay. In each of the past 2 years, the city saw more than 7,000 foreclosures, making it one of the most heavily affected American cities. Cleveland's suit is an expanded version of a similar case filed by the city of Baltimore, Maryland, against Wells Fargo for allegedly violating fair housing laws and targeting African Americans in their high mortgage lending. City officials in Cleveland are expecting their lawsuit's damages to reach into the hundreds of millions of dollars, at least. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, Governor John Corzine is hitting the campaign trail. But he's not rallying support for re-election or stumping for presidential candidates. He's heading out to his constituents to drum up support for tolling the state's highways. He has proposed to raise the highway's tolls by 50% every year between 2010 and 2022, calling it the only way to save the state from financial devastation. According to the New York Times, his plan could stand to pull in more than $38 billion, affording it enough to pay off a significant amount of debt and make much-needed improvements to the state's infrastructure and transportation system. But despite the potential benefits, the governor has his work cut out for him in convincing the voters to back his plan. State Republicans are widely against it, and when voters were polled about the idea in August, more than 60% were opposed. And while New Jersey is looking for ways to raise the cost of driving, India has just seen its own costs plummet. The Indian automaker Tata Motors has just unveiled the world's cheapest car, the $2,500 Nano. According to the Associated Press, the four-door subcompact is widely expected to show big sales throughout India and the developing world. But many environmentalists and planners are expressing concerns about the unintended consequences of its affordability. With already crowded streets and few resources to improve the necessary road infrastructure, developing countries like India may face significant congestion and pollution problems from this new car. The long-term effects of the world's cheapest car remain to be seen, but by year's end, the cars can surely be expected to be found on the roads of India, whether flowing freely or stuck bumper to bumper. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk to two education researchers who are challenging the definition of student achievement with their observations of some of the nation's best visual arts educators. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Ellen Winner and Lois Hetland are the co-principal investigators of a recent research project by Project Zero, an arts education program at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Their research project is called Studio Thinking, The Real Benefits of Visual Arts Education. Ellen is professor of psychology at Boston College. Lois is an associate professor of art education at the Massachusetts College of Art. Ellen, Lois, sadly, I had almost no art education in primary school. I had a choice of band or vocal in middle school and nothing in high school. So the 60s were certainly not the golden age of arts education, at least in my hometown. Can you point to a time when arts education was treated like something more than an afterthought?
I don't.
Wow, what a hard question.
Yeah, I actually don't think that it's ever been treated very seriously in this country, though. In the 19th century, drawing was considered an important skill to have. And earlier in this century, though I can't be specific on dates, I think that it was given somewhat more time. But it's been since 1957 with Sputnik that there has been a feeling that what's most important is math and science, and the arts are therefore relegated to the sidelines.
And you could even send it back further than that if you thought about Piaget's focus on the mathematical, logical kind of thinking as sort of the epitome of intelligence. So, I mean, in education and in psychology, the arts have been sidelined for pretty much forever.
Yes, I think that bringing up Piaget is very important. For Piaget, the great developmental psychologist who's influenced all of our thinking about child development, the end state of development is scientific, logical thinking, and he didn't have anything to say about the arts.
But for multiple reasons, Ellen, arts education, whatever there was, is being cut back at schools across the country, in part as a response to No Child Left Behind and the testing that requires, the performance standards now in math and literacy that schools are fighting to meet, sometimes, I guess, in response to pinched funding. But your research suggests that's a bad idea. Why?
Yes, we believe that the arts teach some very important skills when the arts are taught well that are not measured by the kinds of tests we choose to administer to our children. We found, after studying five arts teachers teaching the visual arts in two high schools in the Boston area, that teachers were spending a lot of time teaching students to do the following kinds of things: to look more closely, to develop their observational skills. Clearly, that's a skill that's important in all areas of the curriculum and outside of school as well. That's one. They were also teaching students to envision, to imagine what could not be seen. Another skill, very important, broadly speaking. They were teaching students to reflect on what they were doing, because art teachers are constantly asking students, why are you doing this? What are you trying to achieve? What is working here and what is not working? So this kind of metacognition, self-reflection, is stressed in the art studio, and this is also a very important skill. Those are just three of the skills that we found being taught.
Lois, are there others?
Sure. There are actually eight in total, and in fact we call them dispositions, because what we mean by that is that they're not only skills, they're not only the ability to do certain kinds of things, but they're also the inclination to actually put those things to work, which is a critical feature. Kids need to learn not only what to do, but to actually do it. And then the third part of it is the alertness, which is the capacity to recognize when it would make sense to use this particular skill. So we're talking about 8 dispositions that include skills, inclination, and alertness, all of them. So Ellen mentioned 3, but stretch and explore is another very important one that talks about artists walking sort of to the edge of their capacity and leaping off and making errors and figuring out how those errors are diagnostic or how they are opportunities for new creation. And that's a critical feature of a world that's changing as quickly as ours is. So we're really trying to think about how to develop kids who can face novelty and confusing situations. So stretch and explore is one of the habits of mind. We talk about understanding the art world, and that includes both works of art and also communities of artists, which means that the kids are being taught to work collaboratively, to listen to peers, to think about how to talk to people about things that are vague and ambiguous, and to try and achieve shared meaning. So engage and persist is another one that we think is really critically important. Kids need to learn how to actually find their passions and then to learn to stick with them and hold on to them so that they can actually develop an understanding. It takes a long time to develop understanding. It's not something that happens in a sort of a right answer quick kind of approach. You actually have to stick with the problems for a good deal of time. So one of the things we saw being taught in the art class was that kids were taught to find problems that were important and engaging both to them and to a community of others, and also to learn the skills of sticking with them through difficulties.
So if I could just summarize briefly the habits of mind that we believe are being taught in visual arts classes. Students are being taught to learn to see better. That's number one. Students are being taught to envision what they cannot see. That's number two. They're being taught to express, I don't think we mentioned that, to express, to go beyond technique and express something in their own personal voice. They're being taught to reflect on their own, to reflect about what they're doing, to think about the decisions they're making, and reflect on their own choices. They're being taught to innovate, that's what we call stretch and explore, to try new things and learn from mistakes. And they're being taught to engage, what we call engage and persist, to be motivated and to stick to things and not give up.
Well, it certainly is, and it seems to me that persistence, if you think about the multitasking and the very short attention span we all seem to have today, I would think persistence would be an extraordinarily valuable disposition to acquire.
Absolutely. And in the art classes that we observed, students were working for many weeks on particular projects, and art classes lasted for long, long hours. These were not
3 hours.
Yeah, these were not typical schools. These were high schools where students could focus on the arts. But even in typical schools, one could have art projects where students work on them for long periods of time. They're not one-shot deals. And, of course, neither are the projects that real artists work on. They take long periods of time.
This is such an interesting finding on your part. Do you feel certain about what you found? Would it be difficult for an educator to take your research and then apply it in a typical school in a typical classroom?
Well, first of all, you ask if we're certain about what we found, and let me just clarify what we're saying we found. We're very certain that we found that teachers were trying to get students to persist and were constantly not letting them give up. And what we have not yet gone on to show, the second part of our research, which we're embarking on now, is to actually demonstrate that students really master these skills that they're being taught and that they generalize them to other classes besides the arts. Mm. So right now what we're saying is the arts are a place where students are taught these kinds of skills. And so we're certain that teachers are really doing these things. And yes, we do believe, and I'm sure Lois can expand on this, that art teachers can learn from the models of art teaching that we've described and try to instill the same kinds of habits of mind in their students. in regular schools, in schools that don't specialize in the arts.
Lois, do you think there's something about the visual arts, which that's the art form you observed? Is there something unique about the visual arts compared, say, to making music or making films or some other art form?
Well, I actually think that each art form does sort of have a lean or an emphasis that varies. For example, the performing arts have much more, they focus much more on ensemble and on group learning and collaborative kinds of projects. It's not that visual arts doesn't do that, but that those do it all the time because they are so much ensemble arts. But what we have found is that when we've showed the studio habits of mind to artists and art teachers in other art forms, that they go, oh, that works for me. And that's exactly what I do. And so, you know, the drama teachers may say something like, instead of observe, I would call that attend. Or they might say, a music teacher might say, instead of observe, I'd call it listen and observe. Or, you know, instead of studio practice, I'd say ensemble practice or ensemble in practice or something. But in general, they just think these work for them as well as for visual arts.
And I wanted to mention that we're actually in touch with people from the Boston Ballet who have taken our model and are actually using this to show that these kinds of habits of mind apply in ballet learning.
I know one of the rationales for more arts education in recent years has been, well, arts education helps students perform better in math, as an example. Do you reject that argument?
Lois and I reviewed all of the studies that have been done since 1950, published and unpublished, looking at whether training in some art form improves performance in some non-art form. And we distinguish between the correlational studies and the experimental studies. The correlational studies simply say, do students who do well in academics also do well, take a lot of arts? And the answer to that is yes. The experimental studies try to get at causality, and they divide students up into two groups and give one group a lot of arts, and one group gets either nothing or something else. In most cases, it was nothing in the studies that we've reviewed. And they looked at the kids before and found no difference. And after they'd had the arts for, say, a few months or a year, they wanted to find out whether the kids who had the arts did better academically than the kids who did not. And those studies did not show any consistent benefit in academic achievement for the kids who had the arts.
Except in drama.
What is it about drama that leads to higher performance?
For one thing, a lot of good research has been done in drama. Good research in meaning that it's the kind of research that actually can give us a numerical effect that we can then average and, you know, put into a giant meta-analytic study. So we have lots of data. It's very reliable and valid data. And what it demonstrates is that all kinds of verbal learning, from learning about story structure to learning about to being able to write to, just all sorts of
verbal memory.
All kinds of verbal abilities.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was only vocabulary that wasn't developed, hadn't been demonstrated to be developed by drama. And this is classroom drama. So this is a very powerful and strong effect that shows that this happens. And it makes a lot of sense because language is part of the art form of drama. I mean, it's
sure.
The verbal and bodily enacted art. But so, in other words, they're practicing what they're doing, and that's the way you learn, is you do the thing that you're needing to learn.
But overall, your contention is that we need to value arts education for a different reason, and the different reason are these dispositions that you've described that students engaged in an arts education acquire.
Yes. But yeah. I also want to say that the clear answer to the question about transfer that you raise, you know, does taking art make you smarter in math, is it hasn't been demonstrated yet, so we'll say no. But if we're talking about my personal belief is that when the arts are taught well and when they are taught with the intention of using them to help develop understanding in another topic, that it can be very helpful for a variety of reasons. It has not been demonstrated, and that is the case that we are making. And not only are we saying it hasn't been demonstrated, but we're saying even if it is demonstrated, the art should not be justified by those kinds of arguments, because it belittles the arts and it takes away an understanding and appreciation for the kinds of things that the arts do teach, which we've demonstrated are these eight habits of mind.
Mm-hmm. I think that that was a very good summary of our position, and I'd just like to add one thing, and that is when Lois talked about the arts could be used to help understanding in another subject, we have to distinguish between the claim that studying, say, music will improve math, and the claim that if you teach math by using musical principles and explain the math and musical principles, so you're really integrating the two, you could improve math. Those are two very different claims, and I believe that Lois was really talking about the second one, that you could integrate an art form with an academic subject matter and thereby enhance understanding in that academic subject matter.
Let me just clarify one thing. When the classes you observed in visual arts, students were, as you say, working for 3 hours. They were generally at schools that were very serious about art. So your research is based on observations of students in, shall we say, with accomplished teachers, and in a, you know, in a much more serious, dedicated way. So, and of course, that is hard to make happen. I would assume there, at this point, there probably aren't even enough teachers to do that, even if we said, let's do it in all of our schools.
Yeah, we know that we looked at very special kinds of schools, and we decided to look at those because we wanted to see what the arts could do when they were really taken seriously and given appropriate resources.
Sure.
But we do believe that, and Lois has a lot of experience working with art teachers in regular schools, and they have been able to take our model and use it. I think Lois could talk more about that than I could.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, I teach at the Massachusetts College of Art. That's where my faculty appointment is. And I do a program that's called Saturday Studios, in which our art education majors, so these are undergraduates and people who are artists who are getting post-baccalaureate degrees, these folks come and they teach under my supervision. So I give them a course in which I teach them the studio habits of mind and the Teaching for Understanding framework. I teach them some stuff that's been developed at Project Zero. And then they actually teach for the first time. They teach 8 2.5-hour classes to kids from the Boston area who come in to take Saturday morning art classes from them. So what I found is that these kids who are brandy spanking new to teaching walk in, and in 4 3-hour classes and some reading outside of class, over these, and then these 8 classes that they teach with supporting class on the side and private, you know, with a little bit of meetings. In other words, with a little bit of support, they can actually think in the studio habits of mind, create clear understanding goals, and aim for them with rigorous quality art experiences. In their very first time, this is before they student teach, and then they go out and student teach and actually go into the classroom as new teachers. So it's very possible. It's just that we have to give people the kind of support that they need to think this way.
Mm-hmm. Now, if CEOs in business and nonprofits believe that art education really prepares students to envision, to innovate, to persist, wouldn't they be out lobbying to get art back into the schools in a serious way?
They would, but they don't believe it because we haven't changed people's minds yet. All they think about is math and science and engineering. We're really trying to change the conversation, and that takes a long time.
There are people in business who are thinking this way, but if you listen, Daniel Pink, for example, who wrote a book called
Yes.
The Whole New Mind, spoke at the National Association of Art Education last spring in New York City. And he was talking about people in Australia who are asking for portfolios, drawing portfolios, for people who are applying for their business management positions. And there seems to be a certain undercurrent among business people that are understanding this. And certainly Dick Murnane's work at the School of Education at Harvard has shown that the kinds of jobs that are increasing in our society in the 21st century are those that require non-routine thinking. Non-routine thinking is what the arts teach. The kinds of routine thinking that is measured on the standardized tests that we're currently judging our students' success by is not preparing them for jobs that exist in 21st century America. So I think gradually business people are getting on board and the public are getting on board, but it's a long slog.
And let me just point out another thing, and that is that notice that we seem compelled to feel that we have to convince people that we need the arts because of something that they can do beyond the arts. And it is I do believe that the arts can do all of these things if they're taught well. But it's interesting that we don't have to fight hard for why we need math and science in our schools. And reading. We take that as a given. And I think it's really unfortunate that we don't take the arts as a given for our students, for our children.
It's so important. I mean, it's funny. I think people think of mathematics, let's say, as, well, you know, you got to have mathematics to live. But in fact, I mean, the courses that we're teaching in high school, Algebra 2 and, you know, geometry, and you don't actually use those much outside of math class unless you're going on into a profession like being a scientist that uses higher math. So it's funny that we just automatically accept a lot of what's taught in other classes, whether or not it affects the quality of life that people have, but we don't accept it in the arts. And it clearly affects the quality of life that people have if they have developed an artistic way of looking at the world.
Ellen Winner and Lois Hetlin are co-principal investigators with Project Zero, and their most recent research is Studio Thinking, the Real Benefits of Visual Arts Education. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Mass transit can be a great way for out-of-towners to get to know a city. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says the only problem can be meeting the right people at the station.
My first Chicago business trip was an overnighter, so a graduate school friend insisted I visit her parents there and see the historic old house in which she'd grown up. It sounded like fun. When I got into town, her parents told me which train to take to their suburb and said they'd meet me at the station. I left my hotel so early I was able to get on the train before the one they'd told me to take. I figured I'd just get there ahead of schedule and wait. When I got off at my stop, I saw a car across the tracks with an older couple in it staring hard at me. I'd only met her parents once, so I wasn't sure if I recognized this couple. They pointed at me quizzically, and I shrugged, which seemed to connect us. We hugged and shook hands. They said they were expecting me on the next train. Ah, I thought, this confirms it. I explained I'd left the hotel early. They said their daughter had talked so highly of me, and they recognized me because I was as blonde as she'd said. The only disquieting thing was that the woman kept calling me Mike, which is not my name. But I just thought it had just slipped her mind for a moment. Then they said we should get to the restaurant. Well, that was odd, because they'd said we'd eat at their house, which I'd come to see. But if that's what they wanted to do, it was fine by me. As we were driving out through the parking lot, the next train was approaching. And just then, the man leaned across his wife to remark about a man standing on the platform. I looked over, too, and was so shocked I forgot to breathe for a second or two. There was my friend's father. I recognized him instantly from the one time I'd met him. He was looking down the track at the train pulling in, and here I was in the back seat of a moving car with two strangers. My mind was reeling as the woman turned and said to me, "Well, Mike." I sat straight up and said I was sorry, but my name wasn't Mike. The car jerked to a stop. I said I was supposed to meet that other man and I had to go. I closed the door on their stunned faces, then sprinted up behind my friend's father before he could see where I'd come from. I hailed him, and he turned to me with surprise. As we spoke, I had a moment of intense, vivid déjà vu as he and I began having the exact conversation I'd just finished.
Weren't you supposed to be on the next train? Our daughter speaks so highly of you. I was looking for your blonde hair. I nodded to everything while slowly coaxing him to his car to make my getaway. As we drove off, I saw the other couple looking dazed and searching through the crowd for that other blonde out-of-towner. Dinner that night was an out-of-body experience for me as I struggled not to hyperventilate and faint. Back home, I told my wife to say nothing, hoping this would go undiscovered. I assumed that my encounter would be easily buried in a big city like Chicago. Little did I understand the breadth and strength of community. A week after I'd gotten back from that trip, my friend phoned, saying she'd just gotten off the phone with her dad. She paused. He'd been to the barber that day. Apparently, a casual acquaintance of his was there, too, and had told him about this odd thing that had happened to him at the train station the week before. I was found out. She and I dissolved into howls of laughter. I had hoped to stride into town on that visit full of wit, charm, and savoir-faire. Instead, I found myself bumbling around the train station like some rube from the sticks. As the tale of my comic misadventure began to make the rounds of that local community, I realized what good fortune it was that I'd been among friends as I went from one car to the next, learning a lesson about the virtues of patience, carefulness, self-deprecating honesty, and a sense of humor about life's odd twist of fate. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.